Hello and welcome back to PaleoCast. My name is Dave Marshall.
And I'm Liz Martin Silverstone.
And this is episode 81, Coccolithophores, with Dr. Liam Gallagher of Network Stratigraphic. Liz, last night was the annual podcast awards show, and we were again finalists in the education category. How did we do?
Unfortunately, we did not win this year.
Boo.
But the winner was Grammar Girl once again.
Mm-hmm.
But we just want to pass on our congratulations to her and the team. So we're not bitter at all.
No, not at all. But I prepared Grammar Girl a little message. You did well, good, but we wish you'd win less awards.
Share them with us.
I hope she appreciates that use of grammar there.
I'm sure she does.
But in all honesty, I don't think we can really complain about being one of the world's top 10 educational podcasts again. So thanks to everyone that voted for us. It was a public competition, and to know that you're all enjoying the show, that really means so much.
Yeah, it really does.
But for the new listeners who might only have just found out about this podcast through this awards show, can you explain to them what PaleoCast is all about?
Yeah, so PaleoCast is basically a podcast series about the history of life on our planet. So whether we're looking at origins of life or exploring the latest discoveries or reviewing some of the methods paleontologists use, we kind of focus on, the history of life and not just dinosaurs. So we do a lot more than just dinosaurs and sort of what most people think of as paleo.
And I think it's also worth noting that we do a lot more than just the podcast too. In fact, last release date, we missed an episode because we were away. I was live streaming and recording a conference. You were presenting, so that's SVPCA that you should all look out for soon. And then I've just finished editing and released an entire conference from ISECT. So if you like the Ediacaran period and the weird and wonderful Rangiomorphs that you can get in there, make sure that you're subscribed to our YouTube channel.
And as always, please leave us reviews on iTunes and Facebook. We really love seeing those come in and seeing what you guys have to say. So let us know which subjects you'd like to hear from us in future, and keep following us on social media.
So, as we said, paleontology isn't all about dinosaurs, and this episode focuses on coccolithophores, what they are and how they've been utilised in fields outside of academia. But part of this episode, we cover a high-profile murder case of two schoolgirls here in the UK. This case might not be familiar to everyone, especially those of you outside of the UK, so please head over to our website for a little more context, or you can find a lot more details online. And whilst we do just focus on how Dr. Gallagher was involved in the investigation, the second half of this episode might not be suitable for all audiences. Hi, Liam. Thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Dave. Nice to speak with you.
Right. As we always do, we like to get to know the interviewee first and understand how they got into paleontology. So what was your route?
Well, as a school child, I was always more keen on the outdoors than the indoors. So that always led into contact with rocks and fossils. I was lucky enough to have a number of teachers who were also very keen on learning, hands-on learning. So a lot of field trips, a lot of seeing glaciated valleys, cliff faces. So not all textbook by rote learning, but getting out into the open air and actually seeing these features firsthand. So. Early secondary school, my interest in geology and things geological was really first sparked.
And then what route did you take at university? How did you, because you're a doctor, Liam Gallagher now, how did that come about? What did you study?
Well, I went up to Sheffield to begin with, again, a recommendation from my geography teacher, a teacher who I had throughout my secondary education, and he should probably be mentioned by name. Mr. Pritchard deserves great credit for leading me towards this path. He was an alumni of Sheffield, and he recommended I went there, and I was lucky enough to get the grades to do a special honours degree in geology. Whilst there, I did a couple of modules in paleontology and micropaleontology, and got particularly interested in that. There was a master's degree at Sheffield, which I was fortunate or unfortunate, depends on how you feel it went after that, not to get onto. But during that summer, I was taken on a master's degree at University College London, and I was living in London anyway, so that was very convenient. A master's in broad micropaleontology, and that led me on to a thesis on calcareous nanofossils. And following that master's, I stayed on at University College to do research, leading to my doctorate in North Sea Cenozoic calcareous nanofossils.
And from there, you went into the oil industry. So how did that career get started?
Well, once you are finished your PhD, and I was really interested in continuing the research, but back in the late 80s, research funding was very, very tight, very difficult to obtain. And being very recently married and very recently mortgaged, it became clear that staying in academia wasn't a profitable occupation. And I was lucky enough to pick up a newly opened position at a consultancy in Watford. They were looking for their first calcareous nanofossil specialist to join the team there. And they were a consultancy who specialized in working with the oil and gas industry worldwide to solve their stratigraphic problems.
Is there any scope for you to continue your research in your current role?
Yes, here at Network, myself and my co-directors actively encourage continuing research. The science is always moving on, and we feel it's important to keep up to date with novel biozonations, new methodologies. So we're always allocating a certain amount of time during the week to keep our hand in, as it were. In particular with the onshore chalks we have here in southern England. But anything the guys here feel is of particular interest, we always make time to look at that from an academic point of view, and seeing if we can apply those results to our work.
Right. Well, before we get further into the application of your science, let's first just take a step back, and I'll ask the question, what are coccoliths?
Well, coccoliths are the fossil remains of coccolithophores. And coccolithophores are a group of unicellular planktic algae, marine haptophyte algae. In particular.
And what is the coccolith then?
So the coccolith is the calcareous plates which surround the cell body. So if you imagine the panels on a football, those hexagonal panels you get on an old style football, coccolithophore cells are subspherical, and the coccoliths build a calcareous skeleton on the outside of that sphere. Yeah, they're usually elliptical to circular in outline, so interlocking plates around that algal body.
And so when the algae dies, presumably all the plates separate?
That's correct. The algal body will decay on death, and what you're left with is the calcareous plates, the coccoliths, and they will disaggregate and settle as individual units as part of the sediment load.
So these are really, really tiny little things. They're on the nano scale. So how many of them can we really expect to find if there's something so small and it just falls down into even smaller bits? Are they really hard to find, or do we have absolutely loads of them?
No, in a lot of cases, it depends on the type of sediment, but the algae are in such large numbers in the surface waters that on death you're talking millions and millions and millions of individual coccoliths eventually settling onto the seafloor per unit time. So in good marine sediment, there is always a good chance of recovering coccoliths, and in rock such as chalk, there are literally billions of individual coccoliths per tens of grams.
Wow. And if you think of something like the White Cliffs of Dover being made entirely of chalk, it really puts it into perspective. So then how can these be used in the oil industry?
Well, each individual layer of rock has a different assemblage, a characteristic assemblage. So as you drill down through the formations, the assemblages of nanofossils recovered will change, sometimes subtly, sometimes dramatically. So we can label or fingerprint the succession through which the drill bit is penetrating by the differences in those assemblages.
And why do you want to do that?
Well, the oil is becoming harder and harder to find in more subtle and more inaccessible traps. So more and more the oil industry is using horizontal drilling, where the drill bit literally drills along horizontally and has to stay within a reservoir that could be as little as 2 to 3 meters thick. So the ability to recognize the approach to the top or base of that layer is really a valuable tool whilst drilling. And that's something the utility of microfossils and nanofossils in particular has been able to add to the ability to stay within these reservoirs.
Because microfossils and the use of biostratigraphy was something that was originally done in a lot of the oil drilling for oil, but then its use has been waning quite a lot as new technologies have developed, such as the use of radioactive sources on the end of drill bits and stuff like that. So is this horizontal drilling and staying within such a narrow little window of a rock unit, is that really bringing a revival of biostratigraphy?
Well, it did a number of, maybe 15 years ago, the advent of horizontal drilling, I guess, brought the requirement for the number of micropaleontologists offshore up to a critical mass. Since then, there's been a contraction in the industry overall, and fewer and fewer people are being used simply because fewer and fewer wells are being drilled. Back in the day, there was so much money swimming around in the oil industry that they would have 2 to 4 micropaleontologists on the rig, plus a couple of technicians for a very short interval of drilling. Nowadays, they're more circumspect in their requirements, and it's only really at critical casing picks where there are pressure barriers that become safety critical, or, as I say, within the horizontal drilling, where staying in the reservoir for an additional 50, 70 meters can mean hundreds of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, it's surprising that to a lot of people, when I've told them about my past work in the oil industry, when I said to them, like, the work that I was doing there was needed for a critical point where we pick a casing point because it's going to go down into a high pressure unit of rock, the drill. And if we entered into that, then there'd be all kinds of trouble and it'd cost hundreds of thousands of pounds. And people didn't realize that being a paleontologist, you could be so important in a way.
Yeah, that's what it boils down to. For the oil company, for the oil companies worldwide, time is money. And if you save them time, you save them money. And if you, whilst saving them time, you keep them in the reservoir, you're saving them money and making them money at the same time. And that's a situation they favour.
yeah.
For relatively little cost, one man and his microscope per day, compared to the radioactive tools you referred to earlier, they are hundreds of thousands of dollars per day, per week rental. So for little cost, the oil companies can make or save an awful lot of multiples of that outlay per well by using skilled micropaleontologists, nanopaleontologists, palynologists in the right scenarios.
It sounds like you need to put your prices up.
Well, we always attempt that, but in the current climate, I guess it's a buyer's market, let's put it that way.
Right, so you're out there on the oil rig, you've got your microscope. How does the job work? What's a day on an oil rig like?
Well, days are split into 12-hour shifts, so typically there will be two of you on board, 12 hours each. And as the drill penetrates the rock, that rock comes up to the surface as chippings, 1, 2, 3 millimeter size chippings. And those are collected by a mud logger, and he will clean them off the drilling mud. He will then describe the lithologies, and then those chippings are passed over to us to prepare for, in my case, nanofossil slide, which is just a case of crushing those chippings down on a glass slide with a little bit of distilled water, spreading it out into a thin paste, letting it dry, adding a cover slip, and then popping it under a polarized light microscope. So within 10 minutes of those rock chippings coming to surface, we can have a result of sorts for the geologists and the oil company reservoir engineers to take forward and update their models.
And do you find, 10 minutes is really, really quick to be able to have at least some kind of preliminary result. Do you find that often there's a geologist or the man who's in control of the rig breathing down your neck saying, come on, we need these results like straight away?
Yeah, all the time. You're never alone as a paleontologist on a rig, because even when you're not drilling, you're doing something so curious and so non-oil rig-like. Somebody wants to have a look down your microscope. But during the critical times, yes, the as I say, time is money. So the quicker you get that result, the quicker it can be implemented downhole, whether it's an instruction to stop, to steer, or to circulate for a little longer. It is very easy to be put under pressure for those less experienced hands to give a result perhaps that they think the oil company supervisor wants to hear, rather than taking the necessary time to deliver the actual result. Geology always springs a surprise in any well, so if you're not delivering the result the guys on shore expected, that I'm afraid is just tough. They'll have to go away and think.
And being in that situation by myself as well is really terrifying. When something new comes up and everyone's there waiting for you to tell them what's going on. No one understands what you're doing. I think it's an interesting point that you raised, that everyone comes to have a look to see what this strange paleontologist is doing on the rig, and what are they even looking for? The number of times I've had someone come up to me saying, like, are you looking for, like, a T-Rex or something?
And well, yeah, that's the only fossil they know the name of, is this where that comes from.
Yeah, well, I'm trying to educate everyone slowly.
Initially, it's quite terrifying if you're dropped into that kind of situation on your first hitch. But with experience, you gain confidence. The more and more you go back to the same reservoir or to the same location, you have confidence in what you have seen before and what you can realistically expect to see in that well. And so long as you know your stuff and you've done your research, as we were speaking about earlier, and there's no other reason why the result might be different, you stand by your result and invite everybody else to look at their results to see if perhaps they're not looking at things quite the right way. It's a team. When I first started out, there were people who were blamed and people who were run off the rig for doing one thing or another. Nowadays, it's all about team, and decisions are made as a team, and you live and die by those decisions as the whole team. So it's better in that respect, but you are still under a certain amount of pressure to deliver that result as quickly as feasible.
So that's life offshore. The job just isn't all offshore work. I think you can only work at least two or three weeks at a time offshore. So what's the work like onshore? How's that different?
Yeah, typically offshore, it will be a 14-day hitch, sometimes a lot shorter, sometimes as much as 3 weeks. And then followed by at least one third of that time off before you can go back out onto the rig. Here at Network, we have samples also sent to the office where they're prepared and analysed for non-real time studies, review studies, paper-based studies, and then there's the writing of reports and summarising results from the well site work and other studies that come in. So probably two-thirds office base, one-third offshore would be typical for an early career biostratigrapher.
Okay, and so before we move on to the next bit, I just want to ask, do you have any oil rig anecdotes? Surely you must do.
Oh, my goodness. Well, my very first trip offshore, I witnessed somebody in full survival gear trying to water ski around the rig on two planks of wood, which ended, I think the longest he lasted was about 5 seconds. The man overboard boat he was using as his tow, which was quite handy because it was having to pick him up every year. And I mean, I'm going back 20 years now because that sort of thing definitely wouldn't be allowed these days. A friend of mine who's a geologist, a Norwegian geologist called Helga, is very fond of catching cod whilst we're offshore, and he once filled the bridge between the two platforms with cod such that people couldn't get to and from their places of work. There must have been 200 kilos of fish just blocking the gangway.
Yeah, that sounds like a stop card.
Yeah, well, it would. Again, I'm going back a few years now. All he had to do was hand various people one of these fish and they were happy. Put it in the freezer and then fly home with it once their hitch come to an end. Most other things would be too dangerous in today's world to pass on via the airwaves, I think.
Yeah, sure. And how was flying to the rigs and the helicopters for you? Because I was always terrified. Did you ever have any close calls?
No, we had to turn back a couple of times when the red light comes on the dashboard of a helicopter. I mean, the only difference between flying in a helicopter and flying in an aeroplane, feeling safe or not, is that they wobble about a lot more. They're a lot smaller. They vibrate a lot more. So it's an uncomfortable ride. You're in a survival suit. You're either far too hot in the summer and far too stuffy in the winter because they've got the heaters on. It's just like a box with a rotor blade, really. So we've turned it. You don't really think about it at the time. I've never witnessed a crash landing. There have been incidents over the last two or three years on the routes I was involved in, but touch wood, neither I nor any of my colleagues have been directly involved. I think the pilots are so professional that they know full well that if anything dramatic happens, they're in the middle of it as well as everybody else. So they won't take a piece of equipment offshore that they're not happy we'll get them back to land that afternoon. So I think the professionalism of the pilots and the engineering crews is such these days that they are tragic accidents when they happen and are extremely rare.
So one of the jobs that you were given was providing evidence in a high-profile murder case in the UK. Can you give us an introduction to that, please?
Yeah, of course, nanofossils have many applications, and although it's the oil and gas industry that provides most of our work, every now and again we get involved with geotechnical applications or other forensic applications where small amounts of sediment need looking at for one reason or another. In another case, we looked at some old masters' paintings on behalf of the Tate Gallery to help them provenance, whether they were Belgian or British, on the basis of the chalk grounds that's used as the initial covering of the canvas. So the application of nanofossils to forensic science is known but rarely utilized. It's a very much underutilized utility, actually. We were introduced to the Soham case by Professor Rory Mortimer, who was asked to look at some of the chalk samples that were collected as evidence. Initially, they had been passed to another person who had misidentified some fragments. So very quickly, the use of microfossils or chalk in this case could have gone wrong at an early stage. But thankfully, Rory recognized that and passed my name and my colleague Hayden Bailey's name to the forensic consultant who was leading the investigation on behalf of the police. And they contacted us to see if we could work with extremely small sediment residue, which we said we could. If it was the right sort of sediment, it should yield a small number of microfossils and it should yield a sufficient number of nanofossils to make it worthwhile. So we were furnished with a number of samples by the Cambridge Constabulary, came down to visit us, handed over the samples in sealed plastic envelopes, insisted that everything was resealed and relabeled and signed off at every stage of the process, such that the evidence trail could be maintained. And the results, which we submitted to the prosecution were such that the chalk involved didn't actually outcrop anywhere in the local area. It had only been used on a driveway by a local farmer to provide a firm surface for a track up by his land, such that the only way these chalk particles could have got onto the accused car were if he had driven it up that lane. And that lane, which was known as the Common Drove, was where the bodies of the two unfortunate girls were discovered. So having originally denied any knowledge of that area or ever having been to that area, the accused car contained fragments of rock which were only outcropping on that particular trackway. So his initial statement of not guilty, no idea what's happened, it was nothing to do with me, quickly or subsequently turned to guilty of killing the girls, but he had no recollection of how or an exact timescale of when, and then admitting dumping the bodies in that area.
So can I just take you back on a few points there? Because I think it's really strange that a paleontologist would get involved in a murder investigation. So did you know the nature or the purpose of the work that you were asked to undertake at the time? Did you know it was for this murder investigation or who the defendant was or anything like that?
No. None of that was revealed at the time. So that the results, there could be no accusation of bias in the results. If we knew the samples had come from Cambridgeshire, for instance, you would instantly have a bias towards what those sediments might be. So none of that detail was revealed to us until the end of the case. In fact, until we were told that we would not be called to court to present the evidence because the plea had been changed on the basis of that evidence. So it was all the samples had code letters and numbers, so no location identifications and no reason or expectation was provided.
This was like such a huge story, though. It was in every newspaper, on the news every day. There was updates about these two missing girls, and then all of a sudden you get the police coming in and asking if you could look at these samples involved in a criminal case. Did you not have an inkling that it might be this case?
No, not in the early stages, because at this stage. The accused hadn't been at the early stage. The accused hadn't been arrested. He was very much on the side of the local people going out searching and helping with the searches and gathering in the village hall of an evening and doing whatever could be done to find the girls who were still missing at the time. So from our point of view, these. We had done a similar case down on the south coast where there was some rock residue on a shoe that had been discovered. So we knew it was a case that probably involved either a missing person or provenance of some material that was found either on a vehicle or on an object of some sort. But no, there was no connection with the Soham case at the time. And I'm really glad that was the case, because it's very difficult to keep an open mind if you know or think you know details of a case, which are always going to be one side of a story.
And how much material did you actually have to work with? You said it wasn't very much. Was it enough to confidently get the preparation done and get enough fossils to be able to analyse?
Yes, some of the samples were as small as 2 or 3 grains, so a gram or two of individual liths. We were fortunate in the resulting assemblage was such that it could only have come from a particular subzone within the chalk. On another day, in another instance, the resulting assemblage might have had a longer range and wouldn't have been as specific as it turned out. So the science of those sediment particles, I guess we were very fortunate that we could eliminate such a large amount of the area involved and narrow it down to the band of subcrop that we did.
Have you ever done this kind of work before where you really didn't have that kind of tight zonation, where you said, well, it could be of rocks of any age, really, and so I'm sorry, but I can't help you with this?
Yes, the case I referred to earlier on the south coast was a missing schoolgirl, and some sediment was taken from a shoe that was subsequently found. Now, that provided a good chalk assemblage, but unfortunately it wasn't a narrow enough age range to tie it down to the specific home location of the accused. So that didn't prove to be as vital a part of the prosecution case as they had hoped.
So your analysis, it tied down the sediments on the car to the sediments on that driveway where those bodies were found. Those rocks had to have come from somewhere. It could have been possible that there were other driveways paved with the same materials. Did you have to look at loads of different sediments from loads of different environments around the area as well? Or was it just these two? Is this sediment that we found on a car a match to the sediment we found near the bodies?
Yeah, subsequent to the results, we had to make sure that what we were saying was as accurate and as detailed as we hoped. So Chris Wood, an eminent chalk stratigrapher, got involved and using his expertise in the area was able to say that particular subzone did not outcrop anywhere in that area. So it could only be as a result of somebody digging it out of a local pit. And extensive investigations by the police showed that within an acceptable radius of that area, there was nowhere else other than that trackway where the farmer had access to a little pit nearby that he could dress that trackway with. But anybody else with a car would literally have had to parachute it in and out of that pit to acquire the same sediment on the underside of the axle.
So your evidence sounds fairly conclusive. How well was it received?
Well, we handed it over to the police, who hand it over to the lawyers, who hand it over to the barrister. So you're quite far removed from the actual person looking at it and going, ah, we've got them now. So it's an interesting question that we had no idea how it was received, or indeed was the barrister able to make sense of it. So it's interesting, and I'm afraid the answer is literally I don't know, but clearly it was well enough received to adjust the defendant's barrister point of view, and the court case was having been set up for, perhaps lasting months and months, was over and done with much, much more quickly.
It's the police.
I've said too much.
So given that we spoke before about confidence in your work offshore and being able to work with someone breathing down your neck, in taking on these kinds of cases, how confident are you in your results? Are you confident to take these on, knowing that one interpretation may send an innocent man to jail or even let a murderer go free?
Well, that all comes with experience. The more experience you've got, the more confident you are in any one result. Thankfully, your one piece of evidence is usually matched up with many other threads of evidence. So hopefully it doesn't all fall on your shoulders. But it is an enormous responsibility, and you have to be absolutely sure on the interpretation and not tempted to over emphasize any point because you think that's what the client wants. It has to be hard science, and with experience comes the knowledge of the pitfalls of caving or reworking or when things might not be quite as they seem. It is in the back of your mind, but at the same time, if you let the science do the talking, then that's all you can do.
And so it sounds like you'd be willing to stand up and testify to that. Have you ever been asked to?
Well, that was part of the process with this Soham case. In at the outset, we were warned that it could end in a court appearance, and if we weren't prepared to do that, we wouldn't have been allowed to start the scientific investigations. That was made clear at the outset that should the results prove valuable, we would be expected to make ourselves available as expert witnesses.
And all in all, the murderer was convicted and he went to prison where he's serving multiple life sentences. How have you felt about the whole process?
I'm happy that the results we provided to the lawyers were accurate. And beyond that, I haven't thought more of it. As I say, our evidence was put together with many thousands of other pieces of evidence to make the whole case. So even though we like to think it was a critical piece of evidence that may have changed the course of the trial or the length of the trial, I think. With the other palynological forensic evidence in particular, the right result would have been achieved in the end. But I don't wonder what if, because I'm confident that the results we provided were accurate and were accurately interpreted.
So we've really seen how nanofossils can be used in fields other than the oil industry. So have there been any other uses?
At the moment, I'm working with a student in Birmingham on a project designed by the Natural History Museum. Now, the Natural History Museum have got the world's foremost collection of Cretaceous shark teeth. But what they struggle with is the exactly where these came from and exactly what age they are, because a lot of them were collected as long ago as the early 1800s, and they've sat in the collections for years gathering dust. Recently, a young lady did a project on them and came up with an evolutionary lineage for these sharks based on their teeth, because they're one of the few parts of a shark that actually gets preserved in the fossil record. So what we've offered to do is take a little bit of sediment off the surrounding these teeth and try to achieve a high resolution nanofossil zonation, such that all of these specimens can be put into a really good chronostratigraphic order and assess whether the evolutionary lineage that has been suggested actually works when you've got good time constraints on these individual fossils. So my student Wilf is working on that at the moment, and the museum are excited at the prospect that if this proves to work really well, they can apply it to any macrofossil collection, macrofossil or mesofossil collection they have there. So long as the sediment is marine, there's hope that you'll get nanofossils out of it. And where the fossils are particularly valuable, you need such a small amount literally scratched off the back of the specimen that nobody would ever notice. It's a non-destructive, destructive process. And I'm hoping that the results of this initial study are good, and that the museum will embrace it as a process to help them classify what are world-class collections over the next few years.
Museum collections are notoriously dusty, though. Do you not worry about contamination with these things? Because you're looking at something on the nanometer scale. It would just take a tiny amount of dust to go from one specimen to the other, and you've contaminated it.
Well, what we do is we just literally shave with a scalpel blade the outer surface to remove any dust or slight weathering, and then take the sample we're going to process as a shaving from under that, so a clean surface, and just a few micrograms of chalk is sufficient for a good result.
Do you see a bright future for nanofossil research, and in particular using it for these other applications?
I hope so. As I said, you know, the oil and gas industry, people might think will be dead and gone in 100 years' time, but we need to get our energy from somewhere. And if you're talking about wind farms, wind turbines, these have to be placed on stable foundations. And we've done work with engineering companies to label or fingerprint the chalks X meters below the surface, such that they can be sure these tall windmills are on the specific layer of rock they need to be on. So any challenge where rock is involved, and particularly in where only small amounts are available, then there's a use for nanofossils. We just have to think of it yet.
Okay, Liam, well, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Dave. Thank you for taking the time to listen.
Paleocast was brought to you by Dave Marshall, with Joe Keating, Laura Soll, Liz Martin-Silverstone and Caitlin Coleri. It was made possible by funding from the Paleontological Society and the Paleontological Association, but the show now relies on contributions from you, the listeners. If you've liked this episode, please consider donating, and thanks to everyone that's helped out so far. We'd also like to thank the Ocean Collective for use of their music. Please visit paleocast.com for the supplementary material to this episode and for our archive of past programmes. Subscribe to our Twitter feed @paleocast and like us at facebook.com/paleocast to get all the latest news.